Today's Wednesday, August 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a heated day of testimony in the bank and tax fraud trial of President Trump's former campaign chair.
I think that Mr. Manafort is in serious, serious trouble.
The see that supports Palestinian refugees makes major staff cuts after major funding cuts from the U.S. Dozens of wildfires continue to rage across the U.S. state of California. And Kenyans mark a somber anniversary. It's all on today's International Edition. In blistering questioning, a defense lawyer accused the protege of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort of being immersed in so many lies he can't remember them all, as he tried to undermine the credibility of the government's star witness in Manafort's fraud trial. Defense lawyer Kevin Downing began his cross-examination of longtime Manafort deputy Rick Gates by pressing him on his own lies to special counsel Robert Mueller's investigators, an extramarital affair, and hundreds of thousands of dollars he admitted to embezzling from his former boss. Downing also ventured into territory the two sides have mostly avoided, discussion of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Charges are not related to Manafort's work with the Trump campaign. The aggressive questioning, though, was aimed at shifting blame from Manafort into onto Gates, who pleaded guilty in Mueller's investigation and agreed to cooperate with investigators by testifying in the financial fraud trial. Joining us now is Robert Deitz, professor at George Mason University and former special counsel of the National Security Agency. Thanks for being with us. So what are your observations from another day of this testimony?
To me, there were two interesting things, neither of which is a great surprise. When you're cross-examining, there are a couple of goals. The general, overall goal is to make the witness look totally unreliable and slimy. And that's what the cross-examination today was doing, and with, you know, some success. But part two, what I found interesting was, in this case, claiming that Gates is slimy is basically akin to saying that he and Manafort were working together. That is, the stuff that Gates admitted to, much of it was done on Manafort's behest. So the prosecution tried to sort of remove the sting about the guilty plea. One of the standard things, one of the standard defense tactics is to a witness who's cooperating, who's turned state's evidence, is to say, so you're getting a good deal now because you're testifying against, you know, somebody else. And the prosecution was very good. Good prosecutors always do this in saying, in getting that out on direct examination. But nonetheless, there was a testimony that Gates rented a flat in London to conduct a tryst. There was evidence, admissions, that he was defrauding Manafort. But what he also came through was that he was Manafort's agent for, you know, tax evasion, bank fraud, et cetera, et cetera. How would a jury react? And it seems to me that the defense didn't make a whole lot of progress. That's my take.
Where does this case go from here? Will there be more cross-examination? Are they wrapping this up?
I think the prosecution is wrapping it up. I think they talked about a couple more days. Often at the end of the state's case, there'll be people testifying, effectively just getting documents into evidence. And then the prosecution says, Your Honor, we submit this as exhibit, you know, 235. That's generally the wrap-up. Usually the star turn is very close to the end, other than, again, sort of technical evidence. And then the question, of course, the really big question that is looming here is, will Manafort take the stand? I had to bet, and again, this is based on, you know, no inside knowledge or anything, I would bet he will not take the stand because he can be absolutely trashed on cross-examination just pulling one document out after another. You said your taxable income in year 2015 was X. That was not true, was it? And you just keep hammering. That wasn't true, was it? And it's very hard for a defendant to survive that kind of cross-examination. So I have no idea whom the defense would call.
This case isn't specifically about Russia's meddling in the 2016 election.
Not at all.
And the Trump campaign, but it's been brought on by the special counsel as a result of those investigations. Does the jury know that these two individuals were part of the Trump campaign and that this investigation actually came about from the findings of the special counsel investigating the Russia's interference?
Well, I, of course, I can't answer that specifically. To the best of my knowledge, it did not come up in testimony, but the odds of their not knowing that this is somehow connected to the Mueller inquiry, I think the odds are approach zero.
So do you think that the prosecution was able to make its case?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that, you know, there's a standard thing that happens at the end of every trial where the defense counsel files a motion for a directed verdict. That's a judgment by the trial judge that no reasonable person could find the defendant guilty. It's done pro forma. There's not a chance that Judge Ellis would grant that. I think that Mr. Manafort is in serious, serious trouble.
All right, that's Robert Deitz, professor of George Mason University and former special counsel of the National Security Agency. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Iran is weighing its response as U.S. sanctions bite. President Trump's Twitter attacks threaten to overshadow his economic message. U.S. officials say ISIS in Afghanistan just won't go away. And China lashes out as retaliatory moves fail to stop Trump trade actions. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In the western U.S., a day after authorities said a wildfire in Northern California had become the largest in the state's recorded history, officials gave the state's residents more bad news. Another wildfire raging around Yosemite National Park would have to close the park and the valley for the foreseeable future. Park officials say the smoke has reached hazardous pollution levels, forcing the closure. Across California, tens of thousands of people have been forced from their homes as more than dozens of wildfires continue to burn in hot, dry, windy conditions and challenge the ability to control them. Joining us now is CAL FIRE Deputy Chief Scott McLean. Scott, thanks for being with us under these circumstances. So how many major wildfires are you guys currently dealing with?
We've got about 17 today. Some of those are actually wrapping up and being filed as you and I are speaking. But don't forget that we're also looking at, you know, the fire resources throughout the state are responding to average of 300 wildland fires a week over and above what we're talking about now.
They obviously need attention as well, so they don't turn into something worse.
Correct.
What are the most concerning fires that you're dealing with right now?
Right now we're dealing with the Carr Fire, which is up in Northern California, just outside of Redding. So that has burned about 167,000 acres to date. Continues to burn a little bit. I think it increased in acreage about 3,000 acres as of yesterday. A lot of structures have been destroyed in that one particular fire. We're looking at residential structures over 1,077, commercial structures destroyed 22, and the numbers go on.
So that's a lot of people's homes and
everything
they had, I imagine. I guess when it gets that bad, there's just, you know, there's no way to protect the homes when it's out of control like that.
That particular fire developed so quickly, there was very little time. It turned into what we call a life safety situation. There was a wind event, significant, you know, people call it a fire tornado, which I think is a really good description. It increased the speed of that fire into West Redding dramatically, just in a matter of minutes. It would have probably taken a few hours. So it is so significant that these folks, you know, unfortunately we did see three civilian fatalities and two firefighter fatalities at this time when that did burst into West Redding. But the fact that no more were killed or significantly injured is a miracle. So this is the type of thing that we're having to deal with.
Unpredictable weather and wind and dry conditions. And then the other big one is up in the Mendocino area, Northern California?
Right, just below the Carr, about 2 hours south, 2.5 hours south of the Carr fire, we're talking Mendocino complex. That has increased in size to, unfortunately, take the notoriety of being number one as far as the largest incident to date in California's recorded history.
And that's actually two fires?
Correct, that's the River and the Ranch fire. The River fire is more towards the west side of Clear Lake, affecting Kelseyville and Lakeport. As far as, again, 78% contained, so it's looking really good. They're getting a strong hand on it, but we can't be complacent. Things do happen. So we need to make sure that containment continues to grow And as resources are not needed on that particular incident, they're being shifted up to the ranch.
How many firefighters are working on all of these serious situations here? Have you been getting help from outside of the state of California?
Right. We're seeing roughly the number that's being spread around is 14,000 firefighters into the state of California, coming from 17 states across the nation. We're looking at the Guard, air and ground. We're looking at the Army sending 200 individuals our way this week. We're looking at Australians and New Zealanders. I know there's 40 of those individuals attached to the Mendocino complex as we speak right now. So we've gotten a myriad of resources from all over the world.
Obviously, it must be a very serious situation if that's the case.
Right. So you're looking at 4,700 individuals assigned to the car fire, just under 4,000, but that number is going to continue to grow for the Mendocino complex.
How does this fire season there compare? Are you seeing it getting worse every year?
Right now, we're looking at an incident that's not even a season. We don't call it a season just because of what we're having to deal with. There is no period of time. It's just simply year-round. It starts in January and ends in December right now. So what little rainfall, and I know I'm being a little facetious there as far as with all the flooding that we had this year, plants are still dry. They're 2 months ahead of their drying cycle right now, but they started out dry to begin with. So we're dealing with fuels that are extremely receptive to fire. We're dealing with topography where access is limited in some cases. Dealing with the weather. I mean, the weather has promoted these fires to become very severe and very destructive.
Have you seen things getting progressively worse through the years, the past few years?
Yeah, the past couple of years, significant changes. We're looking at rough figures right now, year to date from January 1st to August 5th, and this is just an estimate. We have a lot more acreage to add to it. There's 629,000 plus acres burned to date in the state of California this year compared to last year's same period of time, 223,000 acres. So that kind of the writing's kind of on the wall on that one.
All right, CAL FIRE Deputy Chief Scott McLean. The New York Times is reporting that the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees is cutting close to 300 jobs and pulling back on mental health services and mobile health clinics following the U.S. decision earlier this year to cut tens of millions of dollars in funding to the agency, which amounts to cuts of more than 80% from last year's assistance. Joining us now to discuss is Hadi Amer, former deputy envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in the Obama administration and currently a fellow with the Brookings Institution. What can you tell us about what's happening and the implications? What are the implications of these cuts?
The UNRWA, the United Nations Reliefs and Works Agency, has an overall budget of about $1.2 billion a year. It provides extremely low-cost, life-saving and vital services to refugees throughout the Middle East, primarily Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the West Bank, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. So the cuts are extremely dramatic. Last year and the year and the final year of the Obama administration and the first year of the Trump administration, the United States provided over $300 million as part of UNRWA's budget. We are the largest donor, but we are the largest donor because UNRWA's work aligns so closely with American values and America's national security interests. UNRWA provides secular, modern education to boys and girls, refugees throughout the Middle East. And so that work, basically, it is a sort of a counterbalance to extremism and to violence that is otherwise existent in the region.
These cuts to UNRWA, what are the implications for the Palestinians?
So UNRWA spends about 40% of its budget in Gaza, and that budget runs 267 schools and provides secular education for 260,000 refugee kids in Gaza. That's 70% of the population. If those schools don't open, that means that you've got 250,000 kids out of school. That's not going to be happy for the Palestinian people. It's not going to be happy for Israel. And it puts them at risk of other people providing that education. And we all know who runs Gaza. It's Hamas, which the United States views as a terrorist organization. And so essentially, by cutting the money for these schools, for UNRWA, they're cutting the money for these schools, which is going to potentially open up these students further recruitment from Hamas. And I don't know how that serves Palestinian interests. I don't know how it serves Israeli interests. And I don't know how that serves the interests of the United States.
We heard Report from Foreign Policy that the Trump administration is moving to strip Palestinians of refugee status. Is that even possible?
No, you're right. No, it's not possible. Refugee status is granted by United Nations resolutions, which give those who have fled a war and violence around the world refugee status, and also gives their descendants refugee status until such time that they have a permanent place of residence. And so until Palestinian refugees have a permanent place of residence, a citizenship in another country, they are, by international law, considered refugees. Now, what you may have heard is that, which is true, which is that the United States has withheld this funding from UNRWA, and because the funding is being held from UNRWA, there is a thought, I believe a misconception, that if somehow UNRWA is not providing services, therefore those people receiving those services are not refugees. That's just factually incorrect. They remain refugees. They continue to have refugee status, whether or not they're receiving services through a United Nations agency or not. I think that there is a belief, there's certainly a belief among certain right-wing Israelis that if refugees are not provided services, they will kind of go along their merry way, and they'll stop hanging out, and they'll go on and become citizens elsewhere, and they'll forget about the fact, you know, that their families lived in a certain village in what is today Israel, and have a desire to go back, or have a desire to have that refugee status identified or compensated for. And I think that's wishful thinking from an Israeli perspective, right? They just want they want this issue of the fact that there are Palestinian refugees to go away, and it's not going away. And so there are some in Israel that believe that if UNRWA is not providing services, that these people will not view themselves as refugees. I think it's pretty clear for anyone who spent considerable time with these refugees that this is kind of a deep and abiding emotional attachment that they have to their land and to their histories, and that they are not going to give up on it whether or not they're being provided services. So I just think it's a misplaced effort on the part of the Trump administration to try to make a problem go away for Israel that can only go away through a final peace deal where Palestinians concede that to a two-state solution, they concede to giving up their right to return to their homes or be compensated for that.
All right, Hadi Amer, former deputy envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in the Obama administration, currently a fellow with the Brookings Institution. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Kenya and Tanzania observed Tuesday the 20th anniversary of al-Qaeda's deadly bombings of U.S. embassies in those countries that marked the emergence of the militant group as a global security threat. More than 250 people were killed and nearly 5,000 others wounded in huge explosions that occurred minutes apart in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. Victims' families and officials were reunited at a ceremony in a memorial park built on the site of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi. The ceremony was attended by U.S. Ambassador to Kenya, Robert Godek.
As we reflect on the attack, we know that Al-Qaeda had not one, but three terrible goals. Their immediate purpose was to kill and destroy, but they had more in mind. They sought to divide us, to divide friends, to divide Kenya and the United States, and they sought to undermine the values we hold dear, to destroy civilization itself and replace it with a nightmare of oppression. But today, on the 20th anniversary of the attacks here in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam, we say clearly and loudly that although we have suffered, we are not beaten. We will never let those who traffic death and destruction defeat us.
The Nairobi Chamber Choir performed Kenyan and American national anthems and participants holding candles while the names of the victims were read. A similar memorial was held in Dar es Salaam. 62-year-old Indra Nooyi has announced she's stepping down in October as chief executive of giant soft drink multinational PepsiCo after 12 years at the helm. She will remain chairwoman until early next year. The announcement ends a storied career with PepsiCo that extends nearly 25 years for the Indian-born woman, a rare sight among leaders of Fortune 500 corporations. The company's revenues nearly doubled under her leadership as it moved toward a more nutritious portfolio of drinks and snacks. IHS Global Insight chief economist Rajiv Biswas has followed Nooyi's career. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Nooyi is an iconic figure in India, coming from a middle-class family in the southern city of Chennai, educated and entering the corporate world there before attaining a scholarship to attend the Yale School of Management in 1978.
At a time when there's a lot of concerns in many countries about trying to develop women in leadership positions in all different sorts of areas, in government, in business, and other areas, she really has set a very high standard in terms of what needs to be done and what can be done. And I think also in terms of diversity, she's also iconic that, you know, an Indian who moved over to the U.S. and started pretty much at the bottom, worked all the way up to becoming the CEO and chairperson of PepsiCo. I think one of the great achievements that she's brought into industry in the U.S. and also globally is to really encourage more female talent to develop. But I think her approach was very much based on developing a pipeline of succession and not just having it by regulatory mandate, which is the government approach that some governments are now taking. But her approach is saying, well, we really got to look at your whole talent pipeline. How do you develop the talent over time? And I think that's really a very important value added that she's bringing to that whole debate. Obviously, as a business leader, she transformed PepsiCo. She moved it much more towards a healthy mix of products. And so I think also from that point of view, her success as a business leader is also very important to recognize.
Well, this also must be a very proud moment for India, given her accomplishments.
There's quite a few Indian business leaders who have become prominent in the U.S. You know, there has been considerable examples of success, but she's at the very top of the list amongst highly respected business leaders. And an example for young, you know, talented Indians who think, well, I can start, you know, pretty much at the bottom of a, you know, multinational or other kind of corporate and work my way to the top. Now, of course, Indian business is also becoming much more globalized. There's a lot of Indian multinationals that are very large global players. So I think it's also important in the Indian context to encourage talented Indian women to be ambitious for the top roles within Indian multinationals as well. And there are Indian women leaders who are very, very successful. It's interesting to see her success in the U.S. I think it's also a very big positive for the U.S. that it's such an open multicultural society that someone can come from India, especially a woman, and work all the way up to the very top of one of the biggest U.S. multinationals. It's a fabulous example of, I think, the diversity and multiculturalism of the U.S., which actually elsewhere in the world is probably not really there in that many other countries.
Indra Nooyi, by the way, told Bloomberg News she plans to advocate for more women to serve at the highest levels of corporations. Women today lead 24 out of 500 companies listed on Wall Street's S&P 500 index. According to Business Channel CNBC, four of the top five U.S. defense companies will soon be led by women: Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Boeing Defense, Space, and Security. Well, musician Lady Gaga will start a residency in Las Vegas in December that will feature two different types of shows. AP music correspondent Margie Sarzaletto reports.
If you like the pop side of Lady Gaga's music, she's planning a special show for you. If you like the jazz side, she's got that covered too. Lady Gaga will do 27 performances at the Park Theater in Las Vegas beginning December 28th. Four of those shows will be billed as Lady Gaga Jazz and Piano, with stripped-down versions of her hits and music from the Great American Songbook. The rest will be billed as Lady Gaga Enigma and will showcase her hits. Lady Gaga stars in the upcoming remake of the film A Star Is Born, opening October 5th. I'm Margie Zaraletta.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What President Donald Trump called a breakthrough on trade occurred when European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker sat down with Mr. Trump at the White House for a discussion that has eased tensions between the world's two largest trading partners. On July 25th, the two leaders agreed to work together toward eliminating tariffs and other trade barriers on all industrial goods other than cars. They also promised to work to reduce barriers and increase trade in services, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, and medical products, as well as soybeans. In addition, the two leaders pledged greater strategic cooperation on energy, with the European Union seeking to expand its imports of liquefied natural gas from the United States in order to help diversify its energy supply. At a news conference after their meeting, President Trump outlined these areas of accord and noted, too, that the two men agreed to launch a dialogue on standards in order to increase trade across all product sectors and to reduce bureaucratic obstacles to trade. And they agreed to work with like-minded partners, including by reforming the World Trade Organization, to address unfair trading practices, including intellectual property theft, forced technology transfer, industrial subsidies, distortions created by state-owned enterprises, and overcapacity. President Trump noted that the general outline of what was agreed to by the United States and the EU is a commitment to move toward three zeros: zero tariffs, zero non-tariff trade barriers, and zero subsidies. The idea is to level the playing field. President Trump characterized the meeting as the start of a new phase in the relationship between the United States and the European Union, a phase of close friendship, of strong trade relations in which both of us will win, of working better toward global security and prosperity. With a $1 trillion bilateral trade relationship, the U.S. and the EU have the largest economic relationship anywhere in the world, President Trump noted. We want to further this trade relationship to the benefit of all Americans and European citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
This is V.